future media makers, and join KBOO on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Nina Packabush. Nina is a queer-identified grown-up teen mom. She's a young adult fiction writer, a zine maker, and a longtime mental health advocate. Nina is the author of the new young adult novel, Girls Like Me, published by Bedazzled, Inc., and Nina's also the producer of Madness Radio. So welcome on the show, Nina Packabush.
Great to be here, Will.
Well, people who listen to Madness Radio are actually somewhat familiar with you because you've been a behind-the-scenes presence. You're the producer. You do the editing and the technical side of things with Madness Radio for a couple of years, taking over from Leah Harris. So I'm really excited to have you as a guest, finally. I've known that your book has been in the works for several years, and I've been looking forward to this, and we're finally getting you on the show. So welcome to Madness Radio as a guest now.
Thank you. I'm a lot more nervous as a guest than I am as the behind-the-scenes person.
Well, this is your first book, right?
Yes, it is.
I have to say, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I know you had written a book. I was excited to get it out there, and you sent me a copy of it. I started reading it, and I was really into it. I really enjoyed it. I mean, first of all, your writing style is very clear. It's almost like watching a movie. So I found like I was very drawn in and very interested and compelled by the book. And then just the description, the experience of being in the psych hospitals and the whole world of being a queer teen mother and the obstacles and the challenges that the main character faces. It was really, really a great book. I'm really glad that you wrote this, and I'm especially glad that this book is out there, because there are so many people who don't have their experience reflected in the media and don't have books that talk about their experience. And as we're going to be talking about on the show today, being a teen parent as a queer is something that's not represented or discussed, but it's actually a lot more common than people realize. And there are very few books that really represent the psychiatric experience for young people in any kind of critical way. So I'm really glad that you wrote this book, and I just want to really appreciate you for that, and also to invite people to get a copy of it. You'll really enjoy it. So
thank you very much. Yeah, that's why the main reason I wrote this book is we just don't see ourselves represented out there in any sort of media, really, especially for teenagers.
And so don't give us any spoilers, but give us a bit synopsis of what the book's about, so people kind of know what they're getting into.
Well, the book is about 16-year-old Banjo Logan. Her mother was a teen mom, and her older sister was a teen mom. And Banjo identifies as queer, so she never thought she was going to end up pregnant. And she ends up getting pregnant by her genderqueer partner. And unfortunately, her partner ends up taking their own life the same day that Banjo gets pregnant. And so it's the story of Banjo coming to terms with the suicide. She ends up in the psych ward, where she meets some other kids, and for the first time in her life kind of feels like she fits in. But anyways, it's the story of a teenager dealing with pregnancy, being queer, coming to terms with somebody close to them taking their own life, and just like navigating life.
So it's a very, very dark read. There's a lot of painful stuff, but it's also a very bright and hopeful read as well, because of that human connection. And that's a really beautiful message, that even through this oppressive, violent, abusive experiences, that we can actually find our way out through finding each other. That's just beautiful. So I really want to thank you for writing this book.
Thank you. Yeah, that's one thing I really wanted to highlight in this book, like the whole friends make the best medicine sort of narrative, because that isn't given any credibility, generally speaking. It's you know, we need therapy, we need meds, we need, especially for teenagers. And nobody stops to think that maybe they just need people they can truly connect with. The misfits of the world need other misfits, and suddenly they're not misfits anymore. And it's powerful.
Often these experiences are really, really horrible. And then if you write about them or talk about them or just describe what happened, people say, oh no, that's not, you're exaggerating, or that's not really how the system is. And, you know, that was maybe back in the days of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but not today. And the reality is that, yes, it does happen today. And your book, Girls Like Me, really captures all those little small humiliations that we as patients go through when we're in those interviews or we're in that locked ward, and the impact that it has on people of just making you feel so much worse and so much more isolated. And so I was really, really struck by the book really capturing a lot of that, as well as the positive side of finding other people that you can connect with, you know, through this experience. But you really put us into that world of being a mental patient and being in a psychiatric hospital in a very vivid and powerful way.
Yeah, I explore in the book, and then there's a sequel that I'm writing right now, but one of the things I explore is the trauma, the residual trauma from being in that experience that my character Banjo experiences. Like, it makes it pretty hard if things happen to seek help because of the fear of that happening again. And also just for my character Banjo, I'll try not to give away too many spoilers here, but the psychiatrist kind of threatening her, like, you have to do this, or, you know,
the whole atmosphere is of threat and coercion and intimidation. That's what people don't realize, and we have a certain awareness in our culture that, you know, being kidnapped and being assaulted are very damaging, negative, bad things. But that's essentially what's happening in forced psychiatric treatment in those contexts. And you describe a lot of Banjo's experience around cutting and the way that she's misunderstood from the outside, but then the way that you describe her own thinking and her own emotions when she's cutting and what it is that brings her to cutting. It was so helpful, I think, to really go so deeply into that. And there's a lot of different experiences like that in the book where you're able to really go into the subjective side of what are really going on with these so-called psychiatric symptoms. And especially the cutting experiences really stand out for me.
So yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to explore regarding cutting, is that cutting can be a coping mechanism. And, you know, a lot of times people freak out when they hear a teenager is cutting and think that they're suicidal or it has to be stopped right away. And
you talk about it alongside smoking, which I think was an interesting connection to make.
Smoking is a coping mechanism. You know, people smoke a lot of times to calm down or to take a breath, step outside.
It might even be more hazardous to your health than cutting.
Oh yeah, I definitely think it's more hazardous to your health than cutting. We know that cigarettes can lead to cancer. Cutting often leads to just some scars on your arms or your legs or wherever you choose to do it. And I think, and later on in the book, Banjo finds a therapist who understands that. And so I wanted to reflect that too. Like, when people, I've had some criticism of the book, only one person has criticized it, but she was criticizing that, you know, I was anti-meds and anti-psychiatry and anti-therapy, but that's not the case. When you read the book and you read it closely, you see that I am not at all. Like, I am for whatever works for each person. And I think finding the right counselor and therapist can be life-saving. It's the matter of finding that one that really gets you and really listens to you and isn't out there to fix you, but is out there to help you navigate your own life.
Well, this is why the book is so important, because there's a huge gap of this perspective in the world of young adult fiction. You know, there aren't stories that really represent the trauma of psychiatric abuse as it impacts queer people and queer teens and queer parents. And so, and there's a lot of queer teen parents out there, and that's something that doesn't get acknowledged. And I think that that when we have an issue that's kept in the shadows and is pushed away and isn't talked about, it gets surrounded by a lot of paternalism. People rely on authorities, they want to control the information flow, they want to just put out a certain kind of ideological message rather than giving people the benefit of figuring things out for themselves and respecting people's intelligence. So it's really important that we have these representations of the dark side and the negatives of the mental health establishment. And so I'm just realizing the importance of what you've done here by creating that pathway and creating that way of connecting people and having their experience reflected. And hopefully we can reduce the amount of violence and we can reduce the amount of trauma by changing the world. And this is how it happens. The culture changes, the books that we read change, the books that are on the shelves, the things that are available to us at the library, that changes, and then society is changing.
Books need to exist that really reflect teenage life, and that adults like to think that, you know, teenagers don't face these really huge and scary things in their life.
Or if the books are written, they're written kind of from the paternalistic adult point of view that just wants to preach what's right or wrong. And you were mentioning before that there was a review that came out that basically was saying, like, well, you know, it's a good book, but it's too anti-meds, or it's too anti-psychiatry, or it portrays psychiatry in a bad light. Well, actually, talk to people who've been in psychiatric hospitals. This is a real experience that really does happen to people, and there's horrible abuses, and it's very dehumanizing for many people. Not everybody, obviously, but for enough people that it needs to be recognized and reflected in the culture, including young adult novels. And that's why what you've done is so important.
The particular review you're talking about called the book bleak. And I was like, well, sometimes when you're a teenager, your life is kind of bleak. And I don't think my book is bleak. I mean, it definitely is hard, and there is a lot of bad stuff that happens, but there's also this underlying hopefulness.
I would agree. I mean, I don't think this is a bleak book at all. I think it does something really wonderful, which is that it faces head on some of the horrors of what it is to be a young person, but then at the same time provides the actual way out of that, and the positive side of finding your identity, embracing who you are in a community of other people who've had that experience. And that's, it happens in the book, and also it's something that happens by the act of you writing the book. You're making that more likely to come to realization. So I think that it's actually a very hopeful and very positive book. And again, I one of the things that really struck me about your writing style is great. I felt like I was in a movie. I was being carried along in this incredibly vivid story. There's a couple of different timelines, and I just got really connected and really interested in the characters. And I think that it does work for mainstream appeal. And I would be great if this was brought into a movie, because it would make a great movie as well. And so the book is also this great window into something that's not talked about very much, which is teen parenting in general. So do you want to say a little bit more about that? So what are some of the other things that people should learn and know about teen parenting in society?
Yeah, so I think the number one thing people need to know about teen parenting society is, if you meet a teenager who tells you they're pregnant and is continuing their pregnancy, what you need to say is congratulations, not oh my gosh, or start telling them, you know, how their life is going to go awry, or, you know, offer them the names of an adoption agency, or ask them if they've considered abortion. If they're continuing it, the only thing you need to say is congratulations. I'm so excited for you. Wow, this baby's so lucky to have you as a parent. Those simple words can change everything. I mean, seriously, I don't think people realize one person being excited for a teenager having a baby can literally make or break their parenting. In the short term, it may look like, okay, yeah, we need a lot of help. We might need government insurance. We might need food stamps. We might need different subsidies. But in the long term, if we get that help and we have people supporting us, we're going to do just fine.
Nina, do you want to read some of the book, like some selections?
I'll actually go ahead and read a little part here where it kind of outlines some of the microaggressions that teen parents face.
I love the word microaggression. I mean, where was that word when I needed it years ago? We didn't have that word, and we needed it, you know?
Yeah, we didn't have that word. We're like, oh, we're just too sensitive.
Right. It wasn't happening. There was no word for it, so it must not have been happening.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is Nina Packabush. Nina is a queer-identified grown-up teen mom, a young adult writer and zine maker, and longtime mental health advocate. She's the author of Girls Like Me, a new teen adult fiction novel, and she's also the producer of Madness Radio.
All right, so this is chapter 12, and I'll just read a couple pages. Mom pulled up to the women's clinic. Ready? No. It'll be okay, sweetie. I doubted that. We walked through the polished glass doors into a lavender room filled with overstuffed chairs in various pastel colors. The walls were covered in watercolor paintings of mothers and babies, most of them sitting in soft-focus flower gardens. We made our way to the check-in counter. The thin woman behind the desk smiled at Mom. "Hello," she chirped. Mom returned her smile. "My daughter has an appointment at 1:30 with Dr. McCann, Amanda Logan." As Mom said this, I realized that I should probably be the one checking in. I suppose that would be the grown-up mom thing to do, but I stayed silent. The receptionist's gaze shifted from my mom to me. Her smile melted into stern judgment. The woman looked me up and down, her eyes resting just a moment too long on my chopped up, scraggly hair, which had grown out into some sort of mad scientist style of disaster, before moving down to my watermelon belly, sticking out under the men's shirt. She handed me a clipboard and pen. "Please fill this out and return it when you're finished." Her voice was hard. Mom put her hand on my back as we made our way to two empty chairs. The room was filled with women, some with brand new infants and car seats, some with swollen bellies. A few had, what I assumed to be, husbands sitting next to them. All were much older than I was. I felt their eyes on me as we passed them. "This sucks," I whispered to Mom. "I feel like a freak." "I know, baby. I've been there. Just try to ignore them." I filled out the paperwork and returned it to the desk. I heard a little boy say, "Mommy, is that boy going to have a baby?" My fingers dug into my palms. It didn't bother me that he thought I was a boy, because sometimes I totally felt like a boy. What bothered me is that girls like me didn't fit into this heteronormative, middle-class, shiny, white world. I was too queer, too poor, too much in the middle of the gender binary, and too young. Did my baby even stand a chance? I made my way back to my seat, flopped down, and picked up one of the parenting magazines from the small table next to us. A blonde mom and her blonde son smiled back at me. "Today's Most Amazing Moms" was a feature story, followed by 14 Totally Awesome Breakfast Hacks for Toddlers to Teens, and Disneyland Planning Made Easy. I flipped through the pages. All the moms looked straight, and if not rich, definitely not poor. They were all at least 10 years older than me, with husbands and houses and all the other things you were supposed to have to make sure your kids turned out okay. I would never be one of these women that smiled back at me, and my baby would never be one of these kids. Shame seemed to seep out of the magazine, up my fingers, and through my body. I felt sorry for my baby. She would be better off if I found some fancy couple to adopt her. She could have a mom and a dad and all the things this magazine said she needed. I flipped to an article titled, "How to Help Your Teenager Make Good Choices." I leaned over and showed Mom. "Maybe you should have read this article." Mom looked at me with tired and sad eyes and sighed. "Amanda Logan?" a tiny woman called from the doorway. Mom and I stood. I heard the little kid say, "See, Mommy? That boy has a baby in his tummy." The mom shushed him as my mom took my hand in hers and we followed the nurse into the reality that I had been trying so hard to avoid.
That's great. No, it's a great book, Nina. It really is. And I think you can hear, this is why I think it would make a great film, is it's just so visual. I was right there. Your writing style is really, really very strong and present. And it really captures what that experience is. I mean, that image of the shame seeping from the pages of the magazine up her arm. Wow, that's what it's like. So there's this side of the book that really gets into the experience of teen parenting. Maybe do a reading of something from the book that brings in the psychiatry elements.
Okay, I think I'm going to go for chapter 9, which is when Banjo is getting released from the hospital. She has met two kids in the ward, a girl named Prue and a boy named Dylan, and both of them are queer. Okay, so here we go. The next morning, when I made my way to the dining room, Prue and Dylan weren't there. As I spooned the soggy cereal into my mouth, I kept my eyes on the hallway, hoping to see them, but they never appeared. They must have been released early that morning. I didn't even get to say goodbye. What if I never saw either of them again? Realizing I was alone in my mental ward nightmare sent the familiar panic racing through my body. I craved a razor blade. I wanted to go home. I missed Rags and my mom and Sam and Henry, even James. I finished my cereal only because I knew the kid needed it, and then I went back to the day room. I curled up on the scratchy vomit couch, closed my eyes, and tried not to think or feel. "Banjo Logan?" I looked up. "Come with me," Gorilla Nurse said. I followed him to Dr. Jack's office. My heart was pounding in my ears. My hands and arms felt thick and heavy like tree trunks. My lungs shrank, only allowing me to take shallow breaths. I dug my fingernails into my palms, trying desperately to ground myself with the pain. It wasn't working. The door was open and he waved me in. The nurse closed the door as he left to go back to the main room. Dr. Jack motioned for me to take a seat in one of his fancy chairs. He didn't waste time smiling. Ms. Logan, I'm prepared to release you today, but first we need to discuss your treatment plan. Translation, your insurance has run out. He laid his hand down on a file folder that rested on his polished desk. As we have discussed previously, it is my view that you have bipolar disorder. Are you clear on what that means? He didn't wait for me to answer. If left untreated, this disorder can become quite serious. Statistics show that 25 to 50% of people with bipolar disorder will attempt suicide. You don't want a repeat of the incident that caused you to land here, now do you? But I keep telling you, I didn't try to kill myself, I protested, even though I knew I shouldn't. Ms. Logan, would you like to go home today? Prue's voice was in my head. Just go along with whatever he says. Yes, I said. Okay, good. Then we're on the same page. He smiled this big, shiny smile. Because of your pregnancy, I feel like continuing the Seroquel is an awesome choice for you. Studies show a low risk to the fetus, and the side effects for you should be pretty minimal. Once the baby is born, we can discuss other possible medications. I'm assuming you aren't going to breastfeed? Of course he assumes I'm not going to breastfeed. He probably assumes I'll fill the kid's bottle with chocolate milk or Kool-Aid. I remained silent. That line from every cop show I've ever seen popped into my head. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. His voice was like a middle school math teacher as it droned on patiently, explaining to me that being crazy was much more dangerous for my baby than a tiny little pill. He continued to educate me on the risk of suicide and psychosis in the unmedicated bipolar. I guess I was about to turn from Banjo Logan, the unmedicated bipolar, into Banjo Logan, the medicated bipolar. Lucky me. The way Dr. Jack put it, because I was now Banjo Logan, the medicated bipolar, I no longer had to worry about growing up to be that person stumbling down the street with my grocery cart thinking I was Jesus as I ranted on about the CIA and scaring people while my kid wasted away in foster care. A few minutes later, there was a knock on the office door. Dr. Jack interrupted his little speech. Come in. It was Mom. She glanced at me and then quickly looked away. Her eyes were swollen and her face was saggy. Dr. Jack motioned for her to have a seat and then proceeded to explain it all to her. Her face went red and she leaned over Dr. Jack's desk. Are you kidding me? What exactly is wrong with you people? She's pregnant. She's been through hell. Medication? Absolutely not. No way. Mom had some of her fire back, and that sent a rush of calm through me. My daughter does not need to be medicated, and I will not have my grandbaby's life risked by your quick fix mentality. I should have known that bringing her to you would be a tragic mistake. Cancel this prescription. When I heard her call this kid her grandbaby, I felt my throat close up. Dr. Jack put his hand on his desk. Ms. Logan, I understand your concerns, but if your daughter does not comply with the terms of her release, I can, and will, seek a court order to have her forcibly medicated. Please don't make me do that, he smiled thinly. You can't forcibly medicate her in this case. I know my rights, sir, Mom countered. He ignored her and turned to me. Banjo, if I release you, are you going to take your medication as prescribed? I nodded. I knew the drill. He looked at Mom, a smug smile spreading like a disease across his face. All right, then. Good. Now I would like to have you be a talk therapist. You'll be provided with a list of my colleagues when you check out. Anyone on the list will be perfectly suitable. The idea of there being other people like Dr. Jack in the world made me shudder. He stood and went to the polished oak file cabinet in the corner and rifled through for a moment before producing a single sheet of paper. Banjo, have you ever heard of a no-suicide contract? Mom groaned loudly. Dr. Jack shot her a look. He scribbled my name in the blank space at the top of the sheet, wrote the date, and signed it. So, a no-suicide contract is a document, a contract, that we both sign stating that when we release you, you promise to stay alive. He cleared his throat. I, Amanda Logan, hereby agree that I will not harm myself in any way, attempt suicide, or die by suicide. Furthermore, I agree that I will take the following actions if I am ever suicidal. 1. I will remind myself that I can never, under any circumstances, harm myself in any way, attempt suicide, or die by suicide. 2. I will call 911 if I believe that I am in immediate danger of harming myself. 3. I will call any or all of the following numbers if I am not in immediate danger of harming myself, but have suicidal thoughts. The numbers are down at the bottom, including my cell number. He slid the paper towards me. You need to sign there at the bottom. I dug my nails into my palms. So if I kill myself, you're going to sue me?
Exactly. How do you enforce a no harm contract? Yeah, it brings back a lot of memories, and that's the horror of the mental health system, is that scenario that you painted is pretty typical and happens over and over and over again. Thousands and thousands of people experience this all the time, and not everybody has bad experiences, and not every doctor is like Dr. Jack. It's not always like this, but it does happen, and it happens way too much. So Nina, we're just about out of time. So give people the contact information and how they can find your website and everything, especially also if they want to know about events, the readings and things in their area around the book.
So people can email me, and my email address is N, and then it's my last name. So it's NPACKEBUSH@gmail.com. They can find me on Facebook or Instagram. I have a blog that sometimes I keep up, sometimes I don't. It's called wehaveraisedpresidents.org. It's a WordPress blog. So you can find my book. You can Google it. When you Google it, put in Girls Like Me and then Nina Packabush, because another book called Girls Like Me came out just months before mine. So if you put in Girls Like Me, you may not get my book. My book actually has a picture of a pregnant queer kid on the front. It's hard to miss. Yeah, so I'll be doing a webinar for the Icarus Project on teen parents, so you can look for that. And I'm actually going to start doing some talks on teen parenthood and queer teen parenthood. So people are interested in that, they can also contact me.
Nina Packabush, thanks so much for joining us today as a guest on Madness Radio. And thank you so much also for being the producer of Madness Radio.
Thanks, Will. I look forward to re-listening to this and editing it to make me sound good.
You've been listening to an interview with Nina Packabush. She's a queer-identified grown-up teen mom, a young adult fiction writer, a zine maker, and a longtime mental health advocate. She's also the producer of Madness Radio and the author of the new young adult book, Girls Like Me, published by Bedazzled, Inc. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani, boing, boing.
Support our beloved KBOO. Why? Because for 50 years, KBOO has stood by us, helped lift us up. Give us a voice, amplified our voice. They have been beside us through thick and thin, through good times and not so good times. In short, they have been beside us as we have lived our lives. That is community radio. In truth, KBOO is really us, all of us. Whether you donate $5 a year or $5,000, or just listen, KBOO is a collective community fabric woven together. It's something to celebrate, to treasure, not just this year, but every year. It's something that every community deserves to have. Invest in the future by supporting us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And thank you for your support of KABU.
It's time for the KABU News at Noon for Monday, March 5th, 2018. In international news, President Trump has continued trade talks, this time acknowledging Mexico and Canada in a Monday morning tweet that warned the two North American neighbors of impending steel and aluminum tariffs if there were not changes made to the NAFTA agreement, which Trump cites as, quote, a bad deal for the USA. Trump went on to say those tariffs could be removed for Canada and Mexico if they signed a new and fair agreement. The EU has responded to these latest threats with counter-threats of retaliatory taxes on U.S. imports such as bourbon and Levi jeans, and has stated they will take the issue to the World Trade Organization if it continues to escalate. China is also preparing for the worst and said in a statement, quote, China would take necessary measures if its interests were hurt. On Sunday, Italians stated their dismay with the European political establishment voting handily in favor of far-right populist forces, which ran campaigns fueled by anti-immigrant sentiment. The national election, which was the first in 5 years, did not produce a clear-cut result and will reportedly take weeks to sort out who will lead the Italian government. It did, however, illuminate the growing majority position of voters, as over 50% supported hard-right parties who have attributed a recent lagging economy to surges in migration. The Italian Democratic Party suffered its worst showing ever at a national election and furthered concerns of a European-wide collapse of the left. News continues on U.S.-Russian relations, as recent threats in both nuclear warfare and cybersecurity have helped push the United States to declare a fundamental shift on national security. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis asserted in January that great power competition, not terrorism, is now the primary American focus. Mr. Putin announced last week that Russia would bolster their arsenal, including undersea nuclear torpedoes, nuclear cruise missiles, and other new weapons. In a Cold War-esque, back-and-forth posturing, Trump has demanded that Congress, quote, modernize and rebuild our nuclear arsenal. Such weapon strengthening goes against earlier promises by the Obama administration that nuclear weapons would be a diminishing part of the American security and defense, and has escalated both tensions and the race for advanced technologies on old fronts and new. Organizers of the March for Our Lives plan to descend